from the Netherlands. This is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, turning tall cane stalks into small, supple reeds for saxophones and the woodwinds.
Here you have a cane of saxophone, tenor sax. Then you have some tubes for alt sax. And if you go up, maybe you will find some clarinet tubes.
Decarbonizing construction. Tons of carbon are embodied in buildings. There's plenty of ways to get that carbon out.
Sometimes you talk to suppliers and you ask them about the embodied carbon of their material, and they look at you cross-eyed and ask you what embodied carbon is. And so you have to give them a hand in calculating and work through that process with them. It's an awareness campaign that often happens at the beginning of the projects.
And the Palestinian village of Jubet al-Dib. Last week, the Israeli military bulldozed its elementary school.
How traumatizing is it to, for years, go to the school, have your teachers there, be learning these important subjects, surrounded by your peers, and then to have that destroyed with no real hope of secure replacement?
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Before launching in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'm David Kattenberg. Imagine the wail of a saxophone in your favorite jazz, rock, or pop tune. Soprano, alto, tenor, baritone, bass. How about that clarinet? Then there's the bassoon and its elegant cousin, the oboe. Their unique tones are generated by blowing over a reed manufactured from the stalk of a tall cane plant. Here's a story about how music reeds get produced. The seductive voice of a clarinet. The wild wail of a tenor sax. The whimsical tones of a bassoon or oboe. Each of these musical sounds is produced by blowing air over a thinly shaved reed sliced from a cane stalk. The reed in this oboe could have been made from cane grown in the Var region of southern France between Saint-Tropez and Toulon.
An American artist wants to come today to visit our factory and he wants to buy some canes, bassoon and oboe. I will tell him to come this afternoon.
Thomas Donati is the third generation of cane producers here in the Var. Back in 1932, Thomas's grandfather turned cane into flower baskets. One fateful day in 1940, an American showed up in search of reeds for his clarinet. The Donatis have specialized in music reeds ever since. For years, they delivered their cane to reed producer Steuer in Germany. The Donatis purchased Steuer in 1994, moving the factory to the village of Carcaran.
Okay.
Thomas Donati takes me on a tour of a plantation outside the village of Pierrefeu, where cane grows sky high. Raw material for lots and lots of music reeds.
Sometimes it's like a deep forest.
Giant cane, Arundo donax, grows all around the Mediterranean as well as in Argentina, Australia, and South Africa. In the southern U.S., it's considered an invasive species. Here in the Var, giant cane is perfectly suited for clarinet and sax reeds.
This is a one-year cane. Okay, the cane is green and soft, and this is a two-year cane. The cane is hard. You have some yellowish color.
Cane stalks are harvested in their second year once photosynthetic pigments have faded away and hard lignins have accumulated. Thomas points out a perfect specimen.
Here you have a cane of saxophone, tenor sax. Then you have some tubes for alt sax. And if you go up, maybe you will find some clarinet tubes. You can potentially find tubes for any woodwind in one cane. Baritone, tenor, alto sax, soprano, clarinet, bassoon, and potentially oboe. But oboe, we use a cane from a different place.
What makes France's Var region such a special place to grow cane reeds? It's famous east wind.
We have le Mistral, which is a strong wind that give it muscles, strength, and flexibility.
Clay-rich soil and high humidity generate cane of all sizes, skinny ones for oboes and bassoons, thicker ones for clarinets and saxes. This cane is grown organically.
At Steyr, we were one of the first not to use pesticides. You know, because the reed got in the mouth of a musician. So the cane has to be cultivated 100% organically.
Fifteen kilometers south of Pierrefeu, in a little factory in the village of Carqueran, giant cane stalks are sliced into 6-inch tubes. Tubes are carefully measured, then sent off in bags for machining into clarinet, sax, and woodwind reeds.
So here you have the bassoon cane, 28 to 30 millimeter. It's a big bassoon. A smaller bassoon. Here we have saxophone, alto. And here you have the tenor sax.
These are for tenor saxophones.
Tenor saxophone. And you have even bigger, the baritone sax.
Oh, those are big.
Very rare.
Thomas takes me into the workshop where reeds are manufactured.
Salut, Marc.
Marc Charpentier is Steyr's master reed craftsman.
I make the model for make the reed. You know, this model is the name is a patron. It's the same name from the patron from the dress. You know, I make that in a steel. I can show you if you want.
Manufacturing music reeds is a painstaking process. A steel mold must first be machined to fine precision. Prototype reeds produced from this are tested under extreme playing conditions. The mold complete, cane tubes are then split into four pieces, which are then sawed to length, flattened, sliced conically, and beveled on their ends.
On est passé de 1 mm à 1 dixième de millimètre, c'est-à-dire 10 fois plus petit.
Thinness is key, says Charpentier. The ultimate aim, reeds that are easy to play and sound great. And out the other end comes an alto sax reed. In the end, it's clarinetist Thierry Maison's job to find out how easy reeds are to play and how nice they sound. In a soundproof room surrounded by clarinets and saxophones and dozens of boxes of reeds, Maison slips one reed after another into the mouthpiece of his clarinet. These reeds have come a long way from the windswept cane fields where they were born. They'll be making music for many years to come. I'm David Kattenberg. Read more about woodwind reeds made of cane and follow a few links at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If you're enjoying these sounds and voices, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe, or donate, or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering Earth stories to listen to, read, and watch. In search of ways to cut greenhouse gas emissions easily, dramatically, and fast, no better place to start than cities and their buildings. Concrete, steel, glass, plastic, and processed wood products take lots of energy to produce, and their production generates greenhouse gases. The supply chains these materials travel down from supplier to construction site, and the operation of the buildings they end up in account for 39% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Buildings, in other words, contain lots of embodied carbon. Decarbonizing the building industry is something that interests Tim Caldwell greatly. Caldwell is president of Shandos Construction, based in Toronto. Buildings, building operations, building construction, building materials, and supply chains associated with those account for 39% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you folks are trying to reduce the embodied carbon in the building industry. What do we mean by that? What do we mean by decarbonizing the construction supply chain and embodied carbon?
Yeah. So we have a goal to be net zero by 2040. And when I say that, I include our subcontractors. The footprint of Shandos as an organization, just ourselves and our operations, so people flying around on planes and cars and having offices and those sorts of things, so scope 1 and 2, our footprint there is about 10,000 tons. Now, when we add the footprint from our subcontractors, it's about 10 times as much. A little bit more than that. So about 300,000 tons. The big challenge is the footprint from the subcontractors. And so the way that manifests, it's really in embodied carbon. So embodied carbon is all of the carbon that has been released into the atmosphere along the entire supply chain of a material. In the course of building a building. And it also applies to like consumer materials, right? So here's a couple crazy stats. So there's something like, I think it's 30 kilograms of embodied carbon in a pair of running shoes. And the running shoes like weigh like 2 pounds, but there's 30 kilograms of carbon that have been released in the manufacture of that. I think the same thing for an Apple iPhone is about 80 kilograms. And so it's that sort of a principle, but it's applied to every single material that goes into one of these buildings. And when you add up all of the embodied carbon that goes into all the materials in the buildings, you get the best proxy that there is for the footprint of all of your subcontractors on the project.
And what are those materials?
So the big ones, concrete, steel, wood, aluminum, glass. There's 5 or 6 of them that are responsible for the vast majority of the embodied carbon on a building. The 5 or 6 that I just mentioned.
Okay, so all the construction materials are associated with levels of embodied carbon. Glass, steel, concrete, fiberglass, all these materials. But then there are supply chains, and then there's waste management, right? Old things coming, getting smashed down and things being built up.
Yeah.
Where is the embodied carbon in supply chains?
So, I think the best way to answer this is to say, let's just take a look at a cubic meter of concrete. And I'll explain how the embodied carbon gets into that supply chain, right? So in order to make concrete, you've got to have Portland cement, which is mined. So while you're mining that material, you're often blasting it off the side of a mountain. You're using large excavators and trucks to transport it to a facility, and you're crushing it up and processing it in a facility that's often burning natural gas. And so there's a whole bunch of carbon that's released through that process. Then you truck your limestone to a concrete batch plant, and you're releasing carbon by trucking it. And then the concrete batch plant mixes sand and gravel, which has a very similar kind of dig it out of the ground footprint. You mix it together with water and you truck it to a construction job site. And you're releasing carbon again as you're trucking it. And we put it in place on the job site. And we've got a tower crane that's hooked up and we're pouring concrete. And sometimes that crane's hooked up to a clean grid. Sometimes it's hooked up to a dirty grid. And you add up all of those steps in that supply chain, and that ends up being embodied in that cubic meter of concrete that you put in the building. Now, people will ask me, how do you have zero carbon concrete? And what you do is you cut out all of the carbon that's released through that process. And really where you end up going with it is you end up using electric excavators, electric trucks. You power your plant with clean electricity. And if you do all of those things every step of the way, the carbon released in the production of that cubic meter of concrete goes to zero. And that's how you get zero carbon materials. The cool thing is that the material suppliers are figuring this out. So as an example, Inland Heidelberg is doing a massive carbon sequestration project in Edmonton, and they will have the ability to produce zero carbon concrete in the next couple of years. And so there's kind of an arms race that's happening with the big material suppliers to decarbonize the embodied carbon in their materials. And owners and government are setting policy to reduce the carbon in materials. So it's a really interesting space.
And the question, of course, is when a supplier says, oh, I've decarbonized my concrete, you know, I've reduced net emissions from the manufacturing of my concrete by 34%, or any other manufacturer makes such a claim. How can such claims be substantiated? Because I gather that a lot of these claims are misleading. I mean, take, for example, sequestration. You know, it sounds great, but it's a highly controversial concept. The question is, you can sequester carbon, but the big question is, how long is that carbon going to be sequestered? Is it going to slowly leak out of the ground over the next 100 years, or is it permanently sequestered?
Yep. Yeah, so you hit on the big thing. And so it is the wild, wild west, I would say, with manufacturers around disclosures on carbon. Now, the good news is there's these things called EPDs, Environmental Product Declarations, and they're becoming site specific. So I can get an EPD from Lafarge that says, here is the embodied carbon for this particular mix from this particular plant. So that's good, but the dirty little secret around EPDs is that the industry kind of decides how they're calculated, and there's not a standard approach. So they're all over the map, and so we as a contractor spend a lot of time double-checking the math and making sure that some fancy footwork has not occurred. I'll give you an example of the kind of stuff that'll go on. There's this topic of circularity in the construction industry, which is great. The folks in the wood industry are doing good things. There's some folks in that industry would say, well, the by mass, a wood material or mass timber, is 50% carbon. So if we put a bunch of mass timber into a building, we're actually storing, carbon, and that carbon's not going to be released to the atmosphere. I agree with that. But then some folks want to plug that in as a negative embodied carbon and plug it into the spreadsheet and make the numbers look good. And I don't think that's the right way to go, because what you're doing in that scenario is basically crossing your fingers and hoping that 40 or 50 years from now, when that building gets demolished or disassembled, that you're going to be able to take all of those wood materials out of that building and reuse them on another project. And I can tell you that that is not figured out in any way, shape, or form. It may be in 40 years, but I think it's disingenuous to plug it in and close your eyes and say it'll be figured out. So you got to watch for those sorts of details that come up through the process.
Now, I would imagine one of the challenges of building a sustainable building with low embodied carbon is getting all the various contractors to work together and to collaborate from the very, very start of the project, beginning with the architects and the designers and the suppliers who will eventually be contracted, to get them all to sit around the table at the very beginning of a project and map out exactly how their building is going to be have low embodied carbon. Is this a challenge?
Yeah, there's a Yeah, there's definitely a challenge there, but I would say there's been a movement to what I would call early contractor engagement delivery methods in the construction industry. So the days of hire an architect, get the architect to design the building and go get three contractors to give you a price and pick the low guy, it still happens, but sophisticated contractors don't show up for that. It puts us in a lose-lose situation. It's not good for the customer. And frankly, there's an abundance of research that demonstrates that the customers pay more through that. There's a large body of work that demonstrates that early contractor engagement, where all the contractors are at the table in an open book sort of format, focused on adding value for the client, and then you fix the price later when the time is right, that's the right way to do things. And so those delivery methods exist. And so we can actually get the suppliers at the table. We can actually get input into the design process. So I would say it's not a contract model challenge. Owners, of course, have to pick the right contract model. I think the greater challenge in doing this is just the level of awareness and acumen about the topic. And sometimes you talk to suppliers and you ask them about the embodied carbon of their material, and they look at you cross-eyed and ask you what embodied carbon is. And so you have to often start with a level set and give them a hand in calculating and work through that process with them. It's an awareness campaign that often happens at the beginning of the projects.
What's the volumetric module or method of building construction? And how would you compare its effectiveness in reducing the embodied carbon of a building than other approaches to sustainable building construction?
So there's volumetric modular. Just imagine school. My friends in the modular industry are going to hate when I use this language, but imagine school portables stacked on top of each other to turn it into an apartment building. That's essentially volumetric modular. The connection to embodied carbon is really around waste. The average waste that's created on a typical construction project is about 30% of all the materials in the project, which is a bit mind-boggling.
30% of all the materials in a project end up being waste.
Now, I should add that those materials are easy to recycle. And so Shandos, since the early 2000s, has been diverting, on average, 80% of our entire enterprise waste stream. So multiple bins on the job site, and you can recycle. So that's good. It's actually quite rare for contractors to recycle of their own accord without being forced to do so by the owner, notwithstanding the fact it's quite simple to do so. But anyways, that's a sidebar. I digress. But typical waste on a construction project is about 30%. When you prefabricate in a controlled environment, in a plant or a fabrication plant, that waste drops from about 30% down to, call it, 5%. And so there's like a 25% reduction in embodied carbon straight off the top, because you're using manufacturing principles instead of the inefficient stick-built approach that often happens out in the field. Now, I would also say that there's a different form of manufacturing process that I think has even better outcomes than volumetric modular. With volumetric modular, you end up with redundant structural components in the building that you wouldn't have otherwise. Another format is what I would loosely call the IKEA flat pack model. So you prefabricate large pieces of the building that can be shipped vertically stacked or horizontally stacked on a truck, and you put it together out in the field. And I would call that multi-trade prefab. And I think that actually has greater promise than volumetric modular. You can get the same sort of waste reductions by using that approach. And you're not boxed in to these architectural forms that are reliant on the module that you create in volumetric.
We've been talking about building construction materials and where they're sourced from and how far they're transported and supply chains and waste management. But we've not talked at all about where the functioning of a building fits into its its embodied carbon. I mean, once it's built and it's working, some buildings emit more greenhouse gases and some emit less. And I'm thinking about ways of building buildings that are just a way a lot smarter. And one particular really specific example that somebody's mentioned to me recently is the idea that, you know, all water in a building that goes down a sink, right, after you've washed your hands or washed out your coffee pot, all that gray water should go right around through a loop and go into your toilet to flush your toilet. And so this is just one example of how buildings can be designed to make them more sustainable. Where do these kinds of concepts fit into your approach?
I would say the thing to that we use to kind of separate these two buckets is there's two terms, right? So the embodied carbon is the actual carbon in the materials in the building. And then operational carbon is the carbon that's released by the building's operation. So if you have a gas line to the building and you're burning gas to make coffee, that's part of it. Same thing, the power into the building over the lifetime of the building is operational carbon. So those are the two things. And then your example with gray water is more of a broader sustainability thing. I think a great place to start, and there's like literally dozens of these rating systems, a great place to start is the LEED rating system from the Canadian Green Building Council. The example that you provided with gray water would be part of that system, and you could get points in that system. And so from a process standpoint, it all starts early days with the client. So, and this comes back to the collaborative delivery method. So early days with the client, we would sit down with the design team and the client, and we would say, what are our goals for this project? What impact are we trying to have in the world? And you basically go through this big menu of all of these things that we can incorporate into the project. And the client says, that one's really important. I don't know about that one. Is there a cost premium with this other thing? And we work through that, and you set a set of goals at the beginning of the project, and that works its way into the design brief for the project. And then we steward the project with the design team to design to those goals that the client set at the onset. And it's my observation that most clients in Canada don't know what they can ask for, and they would know about 10% of that list that we can show them about potential things they could do on the building. So it's a huge opportunity to hesitate to use the words educate clients. It's more about inspiring them about what is possible.
Is it challenging or difficult for a building designer or a future building owner to build a building that's got low embodied carbon or that functions sustainably without releasing lots of emissions? Is that something that's just difficult to do because the materials aren't out there, the skills and the trades aren't out there?
Let's just talk about net zero for a minute. So net zero energy buildings, so meaning the energy that's released over the life, it is not difficult at all to design a net zero building in Canada. Usually what you have is some sort of a geothermal ground loop, and you're using high efficiency mechanical electrical devices and a beefed up building envelope. Not difficult. It's been figured out. It's been done thousands of times. There's a slight cost premium. I actually think that cost premium starts to drop as more and more people do it. So technically on net zero net zero operational carbon, not hard. On embodied carbon, it is much more difficult. I would say there is a easy low-hanging fruit ability to reduce embodied carbon in the buildings by, say, 30 or 40%, just by making better decisions around materials. Once you get past that, it becomes very difficult because now we're talking about the entire supply chain, and you're relying on folks like Inland to decarbonize their concrete, or here in Ontario, the steel industries switching over their steel plants to electric arc furnaces. That's going to reduce embodied carbon by 70% in the steel supply chain. It's going to take them 2 or 3 years to do that. They're spending $3.5 billion to do it. So sometimes we're going to get into this place where we're going to have to wait for parts of the supply chain to do their part. But I think there's so much opportunity for us to focus on the low hanging fruit of the 30 or 40% that's quite easy to accomplish. And by the time we declare victory on that, for lack of a better term, industry will have some other great things that they've been doing. So yeah, that would be kind of my observation there. It's easy until you get through the low hanging fruit on embodied carbon.
Where do government regulations and enforceable standards fit in? Should the Canadian government be coming forward with actual enforceable standards and regulations saying by 2030, all buildings need to meet this standard?
Absolutely. I think that government's role is to raise the floor across the industry for everybody. And I remember back in the days of yore, in the early 2000s, government started to mandate the LEED rating system for taxpayer-funded buildings. And I remember everybody like lighting themselves on fire and screaming and hollering about red tape and government overreach and, oh my God, it's the end of, you know, construction as we know it. And it was a big nothing burger. And so today we build buildings to that standard with no premium capital cost. And if it were not for government leading that conversation, we wouldn't be where we are today. And so I think that's the role. Now, the good news is that the federal government in particular is all over this. They already have a standard that they're rolling out in terms of clean materials. They're starting with concrete. They're setting a goal that embodied carbon in concrete be reduced by 30% across the board on any project that the federal government funds. And they're also looking at implementing or integrating these sorts of principles into the building codes. And I think all of that is good for the country. I think one of the most powerful groups in Canada would be the Treasury Board with the federal government. They already said that the federal government isn't going to fund or occupy buildings that are not net zero energy, operating energy. I think it's just a matter of time before they say, if you want federal dollars, you have to build a building that has 30, 40% less embodied carbon than what you would have built otherwise. And that sort of thing is exactly the kind of leadership we need in the industry.
Tim Caldwell is president of Chandos Construction, based in Toronto. For more information about low or zero building design, construction, and operation, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. For $5 or more, you'll be helping to make this news package happen. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Last week, Israeli military forces demolished an elementary school in the Palestinian hamlet of Jabhat al-Dib, east of Bethlehem, in the occupied West Bank. 45 little kids had been studying in the five-room school, didn't have a permit, and it was unsafe, Israeli military forces said. The European Union, that funded the school's construction, said it was appalled, quote unquote, and called on Israel to halt all demolitions and evictions, which will only increase the suffering of the Palestinian population and further escalate an already tense environment, unquote. Israel couldn't care less what the EU says. It routinely demolishes Palestinian schools, residential and agricultural structures, destroying or confiscating solar panels and water equipment without apology. EU-Israeli relations remain rock solid. Since January of this year, Israeli forces have demolished over 300 Palestinian structures, displacing hundreds of people, including children, from their schools and homes. And demolitions are on the rise. With me to talk about all this is Lara Kilani, a volunteer with a group called the Good Shepherd Collective. Tell me about Jabhat al-Dib, this little hamlet east of Jerusalem with the elementary school that got demolished. Tell me about this. What happened?
So Jebel Deeb, like you said, it's a small village close by here near the Herodium Park near Bethlehem. And as you said, there was a school, an elementary school in the village serving all of the children from the village, which has been targeted by the Israeli military regime, and also specifically by settler organizations. So this wasn't the first time that the village, that the school was demolished. This is actually the second time the school was demolished. The first time was in 2017, and it was rebuilt since then, and it's been targeted by the settler organization, Regavim, which was founded by a name we might find familiar today. I don't know if your listeners will find it familiar, but Bezalel Smotrich, who's one of the far right leaders in the Knesset with a cabinet position today. And so for years, Regavim has been targeting this school in Jebel Deeb, but also other schools and also villages like Khan al-Ahmar to a really high degree of success by filing petitions in the High Court of Justice, you know, the High Court of what is supposed to be justice, and creating this pressure, this political pressure in the Knesset to really do what this system exists to do, which is destroy homes, destroy schools, destroy resources for Palestinian communities. And in this case, like you said, we see school children in a rural area now having lost their elementary school, which, you know, of course, we all understand how essential education is.
And tell me about this elementary school. How big was it? How many kids were studying there? How old were they? Were they, you know, both boys and girls?
Yeah, from what I understand, it was an elementary school. Like you said, I think somewhere I saw the number 60 students studying there, elementary school students. I think it went up to about fourth grade. So you can imagine now, you know, these children, young children who are learning, you know, these basic subjects that we would learn as children in elementary school, not only don't have access to the space, you can see, I think we shared some photos, but there are lots of photos online as well about what a really beautiful kind of space it was in this village. But also I think it's important to understand not only the loss of the space as a resource for the community, you know, as in like a place where these dozens of students were beginning their education, but also how traumatizing it is. How traumatizing is it to for years, go to the school, have your teachers there, be learning these important subjects, surrounded by your peers, and then to have that destroyed with no real hope of secure replacement. I mean, that is horrific, and no amount of humanitarian aid, like tents or whatever for the kids to be able to use, is going to replace that space or create a sense of security until the system itself is changed.
So paint a picture for me, Lara, about what actually happened. Bulldozers came in, soldiers came in. At what time of the day or night did this happen? They just came in and they bulldozed the place?
Yeah, so I mean, most demolitions take place early in the morning, but of course throughout the day. And so I wasn't there. We weren't there for this specific demolition. But yeah, what happens is usually the structure is bulldozed and destroyed beyond reclamation, right? The idea is to make it impossible for people to rebuild from what has been destroyed. So if you're going to try to rebuild the school, not only are you doing it outside of the very, I don't know, aggressive legal system that exists to deny Palestinians access to these resources to begin with. So not only are you doing it outside of that, but now you also have to completely replace the resources that are destroyed.
And in 2017, I gather, in Jubet al-Dib, when it was, the school was demolished, they confiscated solar panels.
Yes, that is another element of Israeli resource theft and destruction that has been that we've seen over the last few years, where, you know, access to alternate forms of energy are stolen and confiscated as well. Because, you know, as you mentioned, in Area C of the West Bank, not only is there such a low percentage of approval for basic resources like building homes, building schools, having agricultural spaces, even having wells, but also access to electricity is extremely difficult in a lot of these areas.
And access to water. I mean, they demolish or they confiscate solar panels and they demolish water cisterns. So, I mean, you could, you know, set up a school in a big tent, or you could build a prefab building of some sort. You know, it doesn't, I guess, take huge resources to do such a thing, but it's just a space. But solar panel and water cisterns, these are vital elements of infrastructure that provide vital resources, energy and water, for people who are, and so the Israelis, they clearly, they want the Palestinians to be deprived of any resources, not simply infrastructure, buildings, but actual resources that are vital, not simply for activities such as schooling, but for life.
Absolutely. I think it's really important that that folks understand that. I mean, I've seen a lot of things. I actually work a lot on the social media for Good Shepherd Collective. So I've seen a lot over the last few days, people commenting things like, oh, well, that home was quote unquote illegal, you know, or exists outside the law.
These are Israelis saying this.
Yeah. Or, you know, people sort of, Zionists saying this. And so I think it's really important to understand that, like you said, the law exists to make sure that there is a situation of deprivation. And that situation of deprivation isn't the end in itself. It's simply a mean to drive Palestinians off of their land, to destroy their communities and displace them so that that land and those resources can be used by Israeli settlers. And we see this time and again. The Good Shepherd Collective is part of a coalition in Palestine, which has called for it's a campaign called the Defund Racism Campaign, which has called for the disruption of charitable funds to be used to support organizations like Regavim, which exists largely off of these charitable funds.
We're talking about Regavim, Ir David, Ataret Kohanim.
El Ad, yes. And yes.
These Zionist organizations, pro-settlements organizations.
Exactly, because a lot of what these organizations are doing, and like particularly Regavim in this case, is it's not just about targeting illegal, you know, quote unquote illegal homes or resources. I mean, what this organization does is target very basic things, like in Masafer Yatta, they've targeted not only villages, like right now, Khalat al-Dabit is one of the villages they're targeting in Masafer Yatta, but also roads, wells, you know, things that, like you said, people need to live. And so it not only creates a sense of insecurity over these very, very, very basic resources, but pulls impoverished communities into spaces where they are going to court, spending time out of their lives to defend the basic resources that they need to live. And the people who are fighting against them in court, who are petitioning the state against them, are funding their petitions with tax-deductible donations from Europe, from the United States. And it's just, you know, mind-boggling.
And it's amazing, you know, at the Good Shepherd Collective's media information, you excerpted, I think it was a tweet or a Facebook post or something from Regavim. And Regavim said, and this is complained about, and this is, I've heard this before, And it's very, I find it to be very typically, it's a very typical modus for Zionist organizations to turn things upside down, to twist things around and turn day into night and black into white. And here they said, Regevim says, quote, complains about, quote, Palestinian annexation of the open spaces of Area C and the creation of a de facto Palestinian state. They co-opt, I think it's obviously very, very conscious and very calculated co-optation of the discourse, the anti-Zionist discourse that talks about settler colonialism, you know, Zionist settler colonialism and de facto annexation and so on and so forth. And they take that and they co-opt it, they turn it around and say it's the Bedouins, it's the impoverished Bedouins who are engaging in de facto annexation.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a really great book by Nicola Perugini. I'm trying to remember what it's called and maybe it'll come to me, but they talk about the human right to colonize and the way that the language of human rights has really been co-opted by right-wing groups in general, by settler organizations, and they talk specifically about Regevim. And I think, you know, they are very effective at doing this, at using language and also affecting the way language is used in the political sphere by, you know, far right Israeli politicians in a way that really flips the situation on its head.
How are demolitions trending? You know, since January of this year, there have been, I have this written down somewhere, I think something like over 400 demolitions of residential structures, schools, agricultural buildings, Palestinian owned, of course, in the West Bank. I think it's somewhere over 400, and it's going up. Can you talk about these numbers quickly and how they compare with demolition numbers inside of the Green Line within Israel proper?
Yes. So one of the things that we note in our demolition reports, in our monthly reports, is that under this political, this current political regime in the Knesset, the demolitions in the West Bank and East Jerusalem have been going up considerably. So compared to the number of demolitions last year in the same part of the year, so January to now we're starting May, the percent of demolitions has gone up 42% during that period of time. And that's also notable because during Ramadan each year, usually the number of demolitions go down. So Ramadan has now happened. And within that period of time, including Ramadan, the number of demolitions is up 42%. So we expect to see more demolitions, you know, over the rest of the year. And also noted in our report is that compared to last year, the number of people being impacted by the demolitions has also gone up by 70%. So we're not talking about buildings that are, you know, uninhabited or maybe belong to a brother who, like a family member who's unmarried. We're talking about homes that are being lived in by people who are being targeted by these processes to strip them of their homes, and more, we see more people are being impacted. The purpose of these demolitions and the purpose of the system itself is really to make life hard for Palestinians, to take the resources away from them. We know that settler colonialism is about the theft of resources, the taking over of land, and the displacement of indigenous people. And the demolition of schools, of homes, of agricultural land and buildings serves this purpose very well because, you know, a person can rebuild their home, but only, I mean, how many of us can afford to rebuild our homes? And particularly when you consider as well, like many of these cases have very long legal procedures that lead up to the demolition of the home, that precede the demolition of the home. So not only are people dealing with this constant insecurity of whether or not their home is going to be demolished, but that they're going through this very long and expensive and anxiety-ridden experience of wondering what's going to happen and what are they going to do when their home is demolished at the end of it. So I really think that, you know, the purpose of this system, just like so many of the other systems, you know, the system of checkpoints that limits Palestinians' right to movement, the attacks on the Palestinian education system, the fact that Palestinians don't have control over water resources, like we spoke about, over electricity, over the sun, you know, electricity from the sun. It's just another very effective somewhat effective mechanism of trying to steal Palestinian land and resources.
And it's all perfectly illegal, right? The European Union, in response to the May 7th demolition of the little schoolhouse at Jubet al-Dib, said that, referred to it as just, they were appalled. The European Union was appalled, and the destruction of schools and other structures, residential structures, violates the, I mean, certainly of schools, and residential structures, constitutes a violation of the international, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Fourth Geneva Convention, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, to which Israel is a signatory, and Israel just does it. And the international community, particularly the European Union, I think even Canada says these sorts of things, that these activities are illegal, that they're flagrantly illegal. And yet Israel just does it with complete impunity.
One of our main complaints, I think we would say here, against international law, is that there's no mechanism for its
enforcement.
For its enforcement, exactly. And so not only in the cases of these home demolitions, but, you know, over the last few days, there have been these bombings on Gaza with the murder of children sleeping in their homes. And you have declarations by the EU, by Canada, by the United States, by many countries saying this is illegal, this is wrong, but there are never any real consequences.
Lara Kalani, last question, if you could answer kind of quickly. What's happening with the little schoolhouse at Jubet al-Dib? Are they rebuilding? Where are the little kids studying?
At this time, I honestly don't know, but I'm sure that the community will rebuild, and that until then, the kids will have some place to study, hopefully in the community that's safe. And I'm sure that folks will continue to remain, you know, steadfast and rebuild.
Lara Kalani is a member of the Good Shepherd Collective. For more information about their work and Israeli demolition of Palestinian schools and other property, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions at Breda in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Please support independent Earth journalism. Subscribe to the GPM or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.